A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost here every weekday from 9 until 1 with my producer Annie Weston on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. This is the time of the week where we welcome the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, into the studios with us. Editor Simon Lambert is here today with journalist Lee Boyce in the studio and Rachel Rickard-Strauss back at This Is Money HQ for their weekly catch-up. We'll be talking about the stories they'd have been investigating this week, including loyalty, it seems, doesn't pay. But what's gone so wrong with the energy market and the Big Six, and why do so many of us just stick and not switch our suppliers? Savings accounts with a 6% interest rate, too good to be true? Are thinking of investing? Well, we'll let you know what's done best over the years: cash, stock, or bricks and mortar. And speaking of bricks and mortar, do you remember the Bank of Dave? Well, everyone's favourite bank owner, Dave Fishwick, is back on our TVs, but this time he's turning his hand to value of our homes. So with the market bouncing back, so too, it seems, is the TV property show. Back with a vengeance, but why do we Brits love watching programmes about property? Plus, we're asking today, as the killer is revealed in EastEnders of Lucy Beale. If you haven't watched it, I'm not allowed to tell you. I've been told off already for telling you, so I'm not going to tell you. We want to know, book, film or TV, what is the greatest whodunit? Annie?
Well, for me, it's Scooby-Doo. I know it's slightly controversial, but you get a bit of variety with that.
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of Twin Peaks, Murder One.
Yeah.
Who shot JR? The Usual Suspects, anyone? In the studio with me, journalist Lee Boyce, editor Simon Lambert. Your favourite whodunit?
Good morning, Georgie. I wouldn't say it's necessarily the best whodunit in the world, but I'm a big fan of Midsummer Murders. It is like a warm bath of homicide. It's lovely. Nice picturesque village. You can look at it and then someone always gets killed in some outrageously fashion. There was someone killed with cheese recently.
Cheese?
Quite fitting for Midsummer Murders, but yeah, someone was killed with cheese.
I'm still getting over a warm bath of homicide myself.
Me too! What a thing!
I thought Scooby-Doo was bad this morning, but that's just taking it to a whole other level. Thank you very much. Simon, Lee, your contribution?
Morning, Georgie. Mine would be Who Shot Mr. Burns? The Simpsons. Which wasn't the best whodunit ever, but I just think back to that time. It was a lovely, bright, vibrant summer, and I remember watching it as a young lad.
Was it one of the Beals who did it?
I think it might have been the kid.
It was the kid.
It was the baby.
Well, I don't know why we're talking about that, of course.
On London Digital and online, this is Share Radio. Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost, here every weekday from 9 until 1. In the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert, with journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Customers, I'm sorry. A warm bath of homicide.
There's nothing wrong with a warm bath of homicide. You can relax.
I just completely lost it. We're talking about warm baths. Customers of the so-called Big Six energy suppliers could be paying up to £234 a year too much. An investigation by the Competition and Markets Authority found loyal customers are more likely to be charged higher prices. Shadow Energy Secretary Caroline Flint.
The energy market is broken because, you know, the vast majority of their customers across the Big Six are not actually receiving some of the better deals or having wholesale cost falls passed on to them as well. And that cannot be right in what should be a competitive and vibrant market.
Well, the full report from the Competition and Markets Authority won't be made available until after the election. But will this draft report prompt more people to switch? We've got your star reporter, Rachel Rickard-Strauss, on the line from This Is Money HQ to give us her response to the findings. Rachel, welcome to us. Could you just tell us what's your reaction to this?
Well, it's sort of what we all knew, that the market is not working for customers. There are lots of problems with it at the moment and things need to be changed. All sorts of issues in terms of customers being overcharged, no one switching and so not being on the best deals. I mean, people are still referring to it after this report as a broken market.
will this prompt a mass exodus from the Big Six? Well, I spoke to Jessica Leonard. If you just stick around, Rachel, and listen to this. She's the head of corporate affairs at OVO Energy, one of the smaller challenger energy companies who announced the greatest cut in gas bills. This was her reaction to the report.
We're delighted, of course, that that spotlight is finally being shone on what we think is one of the most serious, if not the most serious, problem in the energy market. But it is absolutely shocking. I think many people will look at some of the numbers in here, how much they could have saved, and see words like price discrimination, unilateral market power, evidence of weak competition, and be absolutely horrified. What the CMA is concerned about essentially is that because so many people have never switched, and these are people, of course, that were inherited customers that the Big Six inherited during the privatization process. It looks very much as though at this point there's evidence to suggest that if you haven't switched, then you are actually being targeted and charged higher prices. So these companies are able to actually segment the market, split it up between sticky loyal customers who will be charged more, and customers who switch regularly who will be offered the best deal. And of course, there are consumers out there who have access to the internet, who have lots of information at their fingertips, who are following this story in the news and are able to go out into the market and get the best deals. But I think what we're really looking at here is a sort of hangover from the fact that all of these customers at some point were customers of these regional ex-monopoly companies. And as a result, the mindset very much is, well, I've been with my energy company for such a long time, and I used to trust my energy company, and so I'm not going to think about this the same way as I've always thought about switching mobile phone providers, for example. And that's a huge cultural mindset that we've got to help customers shift. I think it's undoubtedly much, much easier for that group of tech-savvy customers who can do this online. The comparison sites are they provide a fantastic service to the market. I mean, they have been criticized by the regulator recently for occasionally lapses in transparency, but actually on the whole, I think that they've transformed the energy market and the ability to go and have a look at what's happening across all of the different providers. On the other hand, there are millions and millions of people out there who don't have access to that facility. And unfortunately, it does look as though those are the more vulnerable groups in society. And we're now looking at figures in this report that say that, that group could have saved up to £230 by switching in the last couple of years.
Now, Rachel Rickard-Strauss on the line from This Is Money HQ. Do you think this draft report and ultimate report will be a game changer for the energy market in the Big Six?
Oh, it remains to be seen what sort of action will be taken. I mean, worst case scenario for the energy companies, they can be broken up if that's what the CMA and Ofgem end up advocating. So it could change the market. Hopefully, what it will do is get people to think about their own energy bills and whether they could be saving. And we've been saying This Is Money for years, switch, switch, switch. Energy companies make 12% more per unit from electricity and 13% more for gas on customers who haven't switched, those who are still on their standard variable tariffs. If you are on a fixed deal, if you do shop round, you're going to end up getting a fairly competitive rate. It's interesting that this report didn't say that profits from the made by the energy companies overall are too high. But what they are saying is if you kind of dig down beneath that number, there's something much more sinister going on, which is that big profits are made from some customers and smaller from others. And the big profits that are made are from the more vulnerable customers, those who don't shop around, perhaps they don't have internet access, those who are perhaps less educated, older, and poorer. And it seems so unfair that these people are the ones who end up, effectively subsidizing the lower prices for those who are more financially savvy.
It's interesting, you do say in your article that customers, and you've just said there, on the most expensive tariffs tend to be less educated, less well-off, less likely to have internet access, and more likely to be renting, disabled or a single parent. Is that really true?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's always the case that those who are more financially savvy, and perhaps there's a sort of parallel with being online savvy, are those who end up getting the best deals. There's no reason why that has to be the case. I mean, the government has just launched a huge campaign to raise awareness of switching. Comparison sites are going at it as well. They spent $110 million on advertising last year. It's just about getting the message out that A, you should switch, and B, partly it's that people don't know. I think a third of those who have never switched didn't realise that they could. So that's part of the problem. But the other half is what many of us, I think, are prone to. It's just this inertia that people know that perhaps they're being overcharged, but think, well, is it worth the bother? And aren't they all the same anyway? And is it really worth my while? It probably is.
Simon, can I bring you in here? What's your thoughts on this? We've said before, haven't we, and not just with regard to energy, but loyalty doesn't pay.
It doesn't really. It's a product of the modern sort of financial and consumer system. I mean, look, the fact is that you can compare things very easily on the internet now, which means that companies compete on price for their to bring in new customers. And in order to offer those very competitive prices for new customers, they tend to do the dirty on the old customers. It's the same with a savings account. You know, you leave your money sat in a savings account, chances are a couple of years down the line, the rate will have dropped to almost nothing, whereas if you move to a new savings account provider, then you can get yourself a good rate. But I tell you what we should do, my suggestion is, if you know someone who is, say, for example, older, doesn't use the internet, or just someone who you think is just likely to have stuck on an old deal, go do them a favour. Sit down with them, help them switch their energy bills, help them find a better savings account, help them, you know, move their money to a better mortgage or something. So fight back against it. Do someone a favour. If you're the kind of person who knows how to do these things and is happy to do these things, go out and combat that inertia yourself.
Absolutely. Also, and rather interesting, that followed on from that draft report, the very next day it came out that the Competition and Markets Authority, who's looking into the Big Six, are also looking into Ofgem as well.
Well, the energy market, I mean, everybody's been complaining about the energy market for years and that they're not happy about it. And they've complained about Ofgem as a regulator as well. Has it been tough enough?
They found a couple of years ago that there was no problems with the market. And then lo and behold, there's a new investigation into it.
I don't think that when it was found that there was no problems with the energy market, I think people looked at that and said, well, that's not true, is it? Because you had this situation where one of the big six would put up prices and then they all put up prices. There didn't appear to be a lot of competition. They'd say that reflects the underlying conditions. And that overall, they don't make particularly big profit margins. But it does seem that things are changing. You've got these small suppliers coming in. They are shaking things up. It is possible to do something about it. So maybe as consumers, we have to take a bit more responsibility and get out there and do it, because there are a lot of people we tell to switch their energy bills because they could save a couple of £100 a year and they're just not interested.
It does seem extraordinary, doesn't it, Rachel, that there's a Competition and Markets Authority investigation and finding out that we're not switching enough. The government's getting behind it with different initiatives. And yet ultimately, doesn't it just rely on us to move?
It does, really, and that's essentially the only thing that's going to change the market. We have to put pressure on energy suppliers by switching, and also, as Simon often says, think about moving to one of the smaller suppliers. You know, put the pressure on the big six. Make sure that they realise that they can't take us for granted any longer. But also, I do think that it's fair that the spotlight is also on Ofgem. I mean, to think that 95% of customers could have saved by being on a better tariff. And yet this market has been regulated throughout the last few years when prices have been going up. I mean, what were they doing?
Talking about cutting profits and prices, British Gas and their owner Centrica saw that their profits fell steeply this week. They're blaming the drop in oil prices and warmer weather fell 35%. And they're saying that British Gas could cut household bills again this year.
All of the big six, when they announced their price cuts, their feeble price cuts, about a month ago, put in this caveat that yes, if the price of gas continues to fall and sustainably, then yes, potentially they could cut prices again. I think British Gas says that it's unlikely this year, but depending on, you know, the climate, that is a possibility. All of them could. And we know from the price cut from OVO, which was around, I think, 10.3% versus the industry average of about 4%, that there must be scope for more price cuts in future. So hopefully they'll go for it. My guess would be that they won't before the election, simply because if we end up with a Labour government, Labour has promised this two-year price freeze. They don't want to be locked into lower prices that they might end up regretting later if wholesale prices change and that becomes unsustainable. So maybe we'll see another round post-May, I hope so.
Rachel Rickard-Strauss, back at This Is Money HQ. Thank you so much for joining us. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of The Mail Online, live in the studio with me. Let's turn our attention away from energy and onto savings. And Lee, you are the savings expert. Now, a savings account with 6% interest rates sounds a pretty good deal. All too good to be true, though. First Direct, M&S, HSBC, all offering these.
These are regular savings accounts, so they're always headline grabbing, you know, much higher rates than what you can get typically elsewhere. So the Best Buy rates currently for an easy access account, for example, is 1.4%. And the best rate you can get for 2 years to fix your money is 2.3%. And that's obviously not including the pensioner bonds, 1 year at 2.8% and the 3 year pensioner bond at 4%. These products typically let you put in a maximum amount of money per month. So that's the regular savings element. You can put up to 250 quid away each month. So actually, it's not as good as what it sounds, because you only sort of earn it as the year goes on. So it's not, if you had a lump sum, this is not for you. You know, you'd have to put it into a different account.
Why do they have such a limited life? How long can you use it for?
I think you can put it away for 12 months.
Why not longer?
I think it's almost just to sort of get the ball rolling for savings accounts quite often. It's to sort of...
Teaser?
I wouldn't say it's a teaser, but I think it's to get you in the habit of saving. And then it is good because over the course of a year, you could end up saving £3,000, which then you have a lump sum, and then you can put that lump sum elsewhere and get a good rate.
Into
an ISA, exactly. So, you know, best rate ISA at the moment is 1.5%, which is not great, but we are heading towards what we call cash ISA season, us personal finance journalists.
Tell us what cash ISA season is. Sounds exciting.
So, well, it used to be very exciting, Georgie, especially sort of 2012 and before that. Basically, banks and building societies would scramble to the top of the Best Buy rates by launching all these great new ISAs to entice people in. Entice savers in. Unfortunately, the last couple of years, there hasn't been as much of a, you know, razzmatazz around this. Banks and building societies aren't falling over themselves to attract savers who want to save tax-free. Large reason for that is the funding for lending scheme, which means banks and building societies could tap into cheap money from the government rather than rely on savers. And I thought 3 years down the line, we're still in that sort of scenario. But between March and May, there's usually a bit of a push, should we say, of some better products. So I've met up with a few savings providers in the last couple of weeks. They're telling me their plans for cash ISA products from next month. So there are going to be new launches, and the new tax year starts April 6th. So you get a new tax-free balance, which is £15,240 that you can save over the year.
You've been looking into the post office launching a new flexible cash ISA. Now, this is quite exciting, quite a different one, isn't it?
I think it's very intuitive. I mean, if you're lucky enough to have £15,000 to save away, but you want to get the best rate, you've got to put it into a fixed rate account. But you can't touch your money while it's fixed without being penalised. What this post office product is allowing people to do, because you can only open one cash ISA product a year, what it's allowing you to do in the whole wrapper is that you can put some into an easy access and some into a fixed account. So let's say, for argument's sake, you put £10,000 into the post office two-year fix, and you save £5,000 in easy access. If there is an emergency, or, you know, rates do start to change, you know, in other savers products, you've got the flexibility to be able to take the money out or, you know, move it around.
But some of the best rates that we're still seeing, article here, tired of rock bottom rates, how to hunt down the best interest deals paying 3-5%. Most of them are current accounts.
It's true. There are some really attractive current account offerings at the moment. And probably the biggest one and the one that's most popular with our readers is the Santander 123 account.
Why is that so popular? We're hearing about it a lot.
It's because if you're in credit in your current account, between £3,000 and £20,000, you can get a 3% rate. So if you get £20,000 in there and you're getting 3%, that's good. I mean, you can't get that anywhere else. You're not even fixing for 3 or 4 years. So people are sort of starting to use current accounts more like savings accounts, and that is where the switching battles being won at the moment by banks. They're really sort of looking to hook people in with these interest rates. Nationwide, for example, offers 5% only for the first year on balances up to £3,000. And there's a variety of others, isn't it? Club Lloyds, 4%. And people are getting attracted into these accounts.
What you've got to consider with one of these current accounts or any savings account that isn't an ISA is the fact that you've got to pay tax on your savings interest. So that eats into it. So you get 20% tax taken off at source. And if you're a higher rate taxpayer, you're going to have to then fill in a tax return and pay tax on the interest later down the line. So that brings the rate down. But actually, even if you take into account that tax, some of these current accounts and regular savers actually manage to comfortably beat what you could get in an ISA. And the thing about those regular saver accounts is, yeah, of course, you don't get it on a whole lump sum. They don't pay you interest on money that you don't have in the bank. No bank is generous enough to do that. But a lot of people do save regularly, so they save every month. So they might put aside £100 or £200 every month. And it's worth doing that into one of these. If you're going to be doing that every month, set up a sort of standing order, pay that money in over the year, and then at the end of the year, once you're up that 12 months, put it into an ISA. Because realistically, the vast majority of people have no chance of filling a 15 grand a year ISA allowance because, I mean, that's £1,250 a month. Most people cannot save that amount of money. So save it up in one of these accounts, and then the trick is put it into an ISA where it's protected from tax.
Great advice there. Talking about advice, your article seemed to really put over the fact that we need to play the banks at their game. What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, move your money. If you've got money sat there in an old account and you're earning a low rate, move your money. You know, play the banks at the game. They're offering very low rates at the moment, and they say that this is because of the low interest rate environment and it's very hard for them. But as I've pointed out before, actually, if you look at their figures, the margins that they make are going up. They're making more money now than they were a couple of years ago. So don't listen too much to their tales of woe. So play them at their own game. Take the tricks where you can. Put some money in a current account, put some money in a regular saver, you know, move your money to a better rate.
Absolutely. That voice you're hearing is editor Simon Lambert. He's joined by journalist Lee Boyce in the studio for our weekly catch-up. Coming up is the TV property show, back with a vengeance.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. If you've just joined us, I'm Georgie Frost, here every weekday from 9 until 1 on Share Radio, on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, with my producer Annie Weston making that pound in your pocket go a little further. This is the time of the week where we welcome the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, into the studios. Earlier we're hearing from Rachel Rickard-Strauss, journalist on the phone. Editor Simon Lambert is here with journalist Lee Boyce in the studio. So Lee, Simon, let's take a look at the world of property now. The big news this week is the Council of Mortgage Lenders released, well, a lot of data that gives us perhaps a little better idea of the housing market, and mortgage lending hit a 20-month low in January. £14.3 billion worth of home loans were issued at the start of the year, but it's not all doom and gloom. Figures also revealed that lending to first-time buyers last year was up 15% on the year before. Well, I spoke to Bernard Clark from the Council of Mortgage Lenders about the findings.
First-time buyer growth was particularly strong, with a 15% increase in numbers. And a good sign of the recovery of the first-time buyer market was they accounted for around almost half of all house purchases last year, which is getting back to the long-term average. So strong recovery amongst first-time buyers, and also growth in the buy-to-let market. Remortgaging was a bit weaker. We expect this trend of growth to continue, but probably to level off a little bit this year. So we expect lending to grow by, say, 7 or 8% over the course of 2015.
What do you put the increase for first-time buyers down to?
Well, they've been helped by a few schemes. Help to Buy has proved particularly popular amongst first-time buyers. That looks to be a quite well-targeted move by a government that was seeking to do something to help first-time buyers. and Help to Buy has accounted for a reasonable percentage of purchases last year. So that's been one helpful factor. So I think it's a sign of some confidence in the recovery of the economy. Affordability is better in some parts of the UK, and we do have some very, very low mortgage rates around at the moment.
Well, that was Bernard Clark there from the Council of Mortgage Lenders. So with record low mortgage rates and the spotlight firmly on the housing market and what it'll do next, it seems to have prompted a bit of a comeback of TV property shows during the housing boom. They dominated daytime TV schedule, and now the slots, well, they're filling up with property again. Sarah Beeny on our screen with Double Your House for Half the Money and TV star. Remember Bank of Dave, Dave Fishwick? Well, he's also making a comeback. This time it's in property. Lee, I understand you've got the latest on this. Just remind us, who's Dave?
So Dave set up his own bank in Burnley a few years ago, and he did a Channel 4 show about it. And he just gained popularity. He's very sort of, I've met him up there. I've gone for a visit up to Burnley. He's just very enthusiastic about everything that he does. And this bank that he's sort of set up in Burnley, looking to perhaps spread it across the UK and all that sort of stuff in the future. So that's where he's at the moment.
Why did he want to do that? What was his mission? And therefore, what's his mission with this show?
A lot of it was to do with small business lending. So he actually started with a minibus business, which he still has, a very successful minibus business. But he was finding a lot of small businesses in the area were struggling. And in turn, that was hitting his minibus sales. And a lot of it was because banks were pulling the plug on lending.
Simon?
Well, I mean, Dave is a self-made, you know, self-made man. He's a businessman, and he saw this situation where banks weren't lending, and he tried to step in, and he found he couldn't actually set up a bank, and he did this whole story about trying to set up a bank, and he actually discovered that there was too much red tape, too many hoops to jump through, so he sort of set up a peer-to-peer lending thing.
Yeah, it didn't
which
sound
not,
like a bank, does it?
Bank. Yeah. But he said he wants to get a banking license. He wants to open a bank, but he also, he's got some properties up there, and he's tried to do, I think, buy to let the right way, where he's looked after his tenants. He's, you know, he's made money from them, but he's tried to do it in a sort of way where you're looking after the tenants, you're making the house good, you're doing it up, you're refurbishing a property and stuff like that. But what I think is interesting about this whole property show thing is that there was a time, if you cast your mind back to those heady days, 2005 and so on, there was wall-to-wall programmes, wasn't it? And it was all about making money, about how much money you could make on a property really quickly. Or there was that whole trend for buying abroad. You know, there were shows like The Next Overseas Hotspot, and the overseas hotspots were getting further and further away. You know, there was some sort of tiny corner of Bulgaria or something where you should definitely be buying. But the situation is, you know, since then, it sort of tailed off a bit. There was the boom turned to bust and things. But now we're definitely seeing a pickup in this. But maybe the tone's changed a little bit. It's slightly more realistic. I mean, one of my favourites is the Sarah Beeny Double Your House for Half the Money, which is all about extending your home rather than moving and how you could get a bigger home. And there's a bit of what often gets called man maths with the figures there, where it's like, you want this home that costs £800,000, but your home's only worth £300,000. You've done this extension, and now it's comparable to the £800,000 home. Forgetting, of course, that it's location that counts in property, and your house isn't next to the £800,000 home. But it does show that you can boost the value, you can do something to lift up the value of the property. And I think that's something similar that Dave's doing in his new show.
Did you say man maths?
That's what it's called, basically.
What's man maths?
As a man trying to justify buying something. So the classic thing is, you know, your partner, you say to your partner, well, I think that we should buy this, and the reason why we should buy this is we can do this and this and this and this. It's the same kind of thing that led me to buy a Peugeot 205 GTI because it's an investment.
OK, whereas we just lie about it, don't we, girls? So a big fan of the property show, Lee?
I am. Absolutely love a property show. And
well,
I think
you wanted to be an estate agent when you grew up, didn't you?
I did indeed, yes. So maybe that's why. But I think it's a British thing, I'm pretty certain, because, you know, we all really aspire to own a home. And although home ownership figures are slightly slipping and more of us are renting, people still watch property shows a lot. I mean, if I've got a day off, Homes Under the Hammer has to be on, and I love it, and seeing them all get done up and all that sort of stuff is brilliant.
But do you think they're getting more realistic? That's the point that you're saying now, yeah?
And I think they're getting more cautious. I always notice now there's dates, so you've always got a sort of back catalogue of all these property shows, and you're watching the show and they're talking about all the house prices, and I think now they have to put on the date of when this was first aired, so you actually know, because things have changed so much in the last 10-15 years. But I think it's more realistic, and this programme with Dave, he just took two couples who were struggling to make the improvements in their houses that they needed to make. And it's just real sort of back to basics, roll your sleeves up, let's get these jobs done. And, you know, he's not looking to help out anyone, you know, as he said, make the rich get richer. Mm. He's just looking to help ordinary people that have struggled to make the improvements that they've needed to make a house livable, yeah, and to make profit on it.
It's a bit of a touchy subject, though, I think, for some of our readers and for many people out there, because this issue of buy-to-let very much divides people. There's the people who have invested in buy-to-let and they've done very nicely, and there's lots of those landlords, small landlords, who've maybe got one property or two properties, and they do really look after their tenants and they look after their properties. And actually, we keep hearing all this talk about how more people should rent rather than buy, and that actually gives you the flexibility and so on. Well, you need someone to rent you those homes. But then the argument against it is that that's pushing up house prices and these people are profiting from the property market at a time when people are struggling to get on the housing ladder. So anything that involves that sort of investing in property kind of thing tends to really divide opinions. It's very much a Marmite thing. And I think, whereas before, when Dave was taking on the banks, everyone was on his side, I think this might divide people's opinions a little bit more.
In your article, Lee, he says that there's $4 trillion worth of property in this country and normal everyday working people can tap into it. Property prices are now starting to rise again. This programme sees me advising people on how to make money from property. It will blow people's minds just how much can be made by ordinary folk. I'm not interested in making the rich richer, going back to his raison d'etre, I think. I only want to make television that makes a difference to people's lives. So what's his one big tip you found there, Lee?
He loves to haggle. I mean, and he is a successful businessman for a reason. And I've seen him in action, and he's as fantastic off screen as he is on screen. And his tip is just to haggle on everything. You know, in the show, he got a carpet, for instance, that was marked for £1,500. He just said, look, I'll give you £750 for it. And that's what they got it for. And he says, just start, you know, by halving it and work your way up and meet a middle ground almost. So I think it's a really interesting tip, and I think a lot of British people do not like to haggle, really don't enjoy doing, and maybe we should be doing more of it. Maybe we should be going into even big retailers and saying, I'll give you this much money for it. What can you
Why
do?
Why not?
Why not?
They can only say
what no. What have you got to lose? Exactly.
Absolutely. He says, Britain seem frightened to ask for a discount. You've just got to take a deep breath and remember it's only words. They can only say no. They won't hurt you.
Exactly.
So there we go. Talking about bricks and mortar and property, we'll be finding out how popular asset classes have performed over the past 30 years. They're thinking of investment, what's done best? Cash, stocks, or property? I'll let you know.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
Well, Simon, you are the investment guru, so you'll have to lead us off on this one. Talking about investing in property, but what's the best option for your money?
So, would you have done better in cash, shares, or sticking your money in property? Now, a lot of people would look back over the last 30 years and they'd go, property, must be property. But actually, you'd have been better off in shares. And in fact, you'd have been a lot better off in shares if you'd reinvested the dividends that companies have paid you. So that helps that effect. It compounds up over the years. So you'd have got a 1,433% return over the past 30 years from shares, whereas from property, you would have only got 402%. But crucially, if you hadn't reinvested those dividends, then the shares would only have been up 433%. But you still, if you'd put your money into the stock market, would have beaten the property market. And I think a lot of people, you know, they look at the stock market and they think the stock market's too risky. And there'll be plenty of people who are happy to put their money into property in this country who say, well, I wouldn't put my money into the stock market. Stock market could suddenly slump. You know, with a house, you know where you stand. But actually, over time, and this isn't the only report that shows this, there's many, many reports that use different periods of time. You do tend to find that the stock market outperforms most other assets over time. And actually, if you look back over those 30 years, the UK stock market hasn't really done that well. It did pretty well for the first half of it, but since the dot-com boom, it's never actually managed to regain its peak.
But you're talking long-term. If we were to take a smaller snapshot, say over the last 5 years, because you always say invest in the long term, don't you?
Yes. Yeah, you want to have a long term horizon. Look, I mean, it depends where you are. If over the last 5 years, you should have bought a flat in London. You would have made a load of money. But you can't rely on that happening. It's very difficult to predict what's going to happen with these things. So what you should be looking at, whatever you're investing in, is what are the underlying fundamentals, which is what the term investors use, which is basically, is this any good? If you're buying an individual share, what does this company do? How does it make its money? Is it a profitable company? What are its future prospects like? Does it have pricing power? And has it got good management? And can it keep growing? If most people will buy into investment funds, you need to look at, is the manager any good? Do I agree with their outlook? Do I think that the investments that they're making are into good companies? I mean, with a property, the advantage is that you can go in, you can do it up, you can, you know, even a lick of paint or a new kitchen, buying a property that doesn't look great, you can actually add quite a lot of value to it. And it's very difficult to refurbish an investment fund yourself.
You've said equities might emerge triumphant over the whole 30-year period in this study. UK homeowners enjoyed a huge surge in house prices, though, since the 1990s, which goes on what we were saying there. Advice is also in here. It said volatility is part and parcel of being invested in equities. But there are three tips to cope with markets' ups and downs. Don't panic when prices fall. When saving long-term, reinvest your dividends, particularly in the early years, and maintain a level of diversification, and do not rely wholly or disproportionately on equities relative to your personal circumstances. All good advice there?
Yeah, that is good advice. And the other thing I would say is, obviously, you know, that's talking about investing in mm-hmm. shares. But for people who are considering investing in property, and there'll be a lot of people who are considering buy-to-let, there's a couple of things that you need to think about. Firstly, really what you need to be looking at to deliver your return is the rent. Is your rent comfortably, you know, covering the mortgage and some more? I mean, this will be checked up when you take out the mortgage. And then that delivers the nice long-term steady returns. And then any growth you get in the property's value is extra on top of that. But just bear in mind that if you are buying with a mortgage, this has the power to magnify your returns. So say, for example, you put down £20,000 and buy a £100,000 property. So you've borrowed £80,000. Well, if you make £10,000, that property goes up in value by £10,000. It's gone up 10%, but you've actually made 50% on the money that you've put in. But the problem is if that property goes down by 10%, you've lost 50% of the money that you've put in as well, because you take the first hit, not the mortgage company. You'll still owe them all the money that you've borrowed. And people forget about that when they're investing in property. And it has the power to make the gains look really, really big, but it also has the power to make the losses quite a lot harder.
Now, this is a really interesting story, I think. Essentially, it is quite simple. Where's the best place to put your cash? But so much financial jargon. And how do you sort of wade through all the jargon and get to the best options that are out there? Or do you just get a financial advisor to deal with this sort of thing?
Well, I was talking to someone about this the other day, actually, and I think that this is quite interesting, is that it's never been easier to invest. So if you go to a DIY investing platform out there, you can get yourself set up in half an hour. So something like a Hargreaves Lansdown, a Share Centre, a Best Invest. You go on there, you get yourself set up in half an hour, and you can be investing. And they'll have, you know, perhaps model portfolios that you can choose, or you could just choose a tracker fund that just follows the market, and you're not paying a fund manager to try and pick winners. You just follow the market. But actually, the sort of younger generation, I think, people in their 20s and 30s, are actually probably much less likely to invest than the older generation in perhaps their sort of late 40s, 50s and 60s, even though it's easier nowadays. And I think that the big difference is that that older generation would have had the financial advisors giving them a helping hand. They would have been more likely to have to speak to a stockbroker who would have got them over that first hurdle and given them that helping hand. Whereas when I speak to a lot of people of my sort of younger 30s generation, they say, oh, I'd like to invest, but I just don't know how to do it. It's too hard. And people need that help getting over the first hurdle, because actually long term, you know, investing is a wise idea. Once you've got that rainy day fund saved, then really you should be investing, because it's the only way to grow your wealth over the long term.
Isn't there also an issue, though, with young people not having that availability of money with which to invest?
Oh, yes, of course. And, you know, money's tight for a lot of people. And you look at the younger generation and, you know, they're struggling to buy those properties that their parents' generation have made all that money on. So they're having to save hard and save more for a deposit. But, you know, there is a reality that whilst there's a lot of people who are struggling, there are also people out there who do have spare money, who have good jobs and good incomes and probably should be investing but aren't because they see it as too difficult. And I guess it's the job of people like us and websites like This Is Money, radio stations like Share Radio, to try and help those people and give them a helping hand.
And of course, with rates so low at the moment, savings aren't great, so people are looking elsewhere, and there are lots of other options as well, aren't there?
Yeah, there are lots of other options. And, you know, and this is where this message comes through about dividends. There's a couple of things that are proven to work over the long term in investing. And one of them is the power of dividends to grow your wealth, which is companies paying out money every year to reward shareholders, taking those dividends and reinvesting them. The other thing is to watch out for costs and try and keep your costs as low as possible. And the other thing that's proven to work over the years is basically to try and buy stuff that's good value. Don't buy stuff that's very, very expensive when it's very overpriced. And going back to that house prices thing, at the moment, we've seen huge house price growth over the last 15 years or so, or especially, you know, in London. So you might think, oh, well, that's going to keep going up. But actually, if it's very overpriced, you need to be wary.
That voice you're hearing is Simon Lambert, editor of This Is Money.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Welcome back to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. In the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce, for our weekly catch-up with the team from This Is Money. They are the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online Now. His topic that seems to always come up when you, Simon, and Lee are in the same room together, and this is the car industry. Well, you've dedicated an article on your main page. There's a couple of articles of This Is Money to the British car manufacturing industry and how well it's doing. The CBI shows that orders rose at their fastest pace since August. Export orders also reached a six-month high, and Jaguar's new XE has been declared a BMW beta by what car? Well, this follows our best year for car manufacturing, hitting a seven-year high in the last year, with new cars rolling off a production line every 20 seconds. 80% of those winging their way abroad, which makes 1.2 million cars in 2014 being shipped to more than 100 countries. Notably, China has become the single largest maker for British-made cars from the UK itself. 60% are premium, such as Rolls-Royce, Bentley, Aston Martin, Jaguar, Land Rover. So, all good news, right? Especially for places for Sunderland and their Nissan plant, which makes more cars than the whole of Italy, apparently, you tell us here. Even though these cars are made in Britain, they aren't British-owned. So, does it really matter? Simon, does it really matter?
I don't think it does really matter. So I think it matters a bit. Obviously, it would be nice if these our car companies were British owned, but the reality is they're not. There were periods, and you know, they were previously British owned, and unfortunately, we made a hash of most of them. And now, though, in foreign ownership, they're doing very, very well. But most of these cars, they are being designed, made, engineered, manufactured here. This is a great British success story. Jaguar, for example, is on a roll at the moment. And this new car that it's launched, it's a BMW 3 Series sized car, a sort of a small executive car. And basically, the reviews have been fantastic for it. And that's not even actually the final version. It's still to be tweaked. But this What Car review, it's really struck gold there, because What Car is the car buyer's bible. It's where a lot of people turn to. And they've said that it beats the 3 Series. It's a better car than the 3 Series. And that is a huge achievement for Jaguar. And what it wants to do is really push on and sell a lot of these cars. And it's now got some of the best driving and some of the best looking cars in their classes.
How much is this?
This starts at £27,000. So it's not a cheap car, but it's a very good car.
More accessible, and, you say, yeah.
Yeah, it's more accessible. You've then got the XF, which is the next car up, which is the bigger car. And then the really big car is the XJ. And you've also got their sports car, the F-Type, which has won rave reviews. And it makes, basically, some of the best cars that you can buy on the road right now. We've got Rolls-Royce and Bentley, which are doing exceptionally well. They're making record amounts of cars. They're exporting the majority of them. And that's great for British industry. And also McLaren. McLaren makes cars that rival Ferraris. You know, those McLaren cars are exceptionally good cars, some of the world's most desirable cars, designed, built, engineered in Britain. And underneath all of that, we're supporting a fantastic industry, and we should be really, really proud of our car industry at the moment. And yes, it's sad that most of them aren't British owned, but do you know what? It's better to celebrate this.
Annie, you've got an email from
us. I have, yeah. So Anthony has emailed us and he says, I think it matters hugely whether a company is British owned or not. He said Jaguar is now Indian owned. They're about to start producing Jaguars in China. So a Chinese produced Jag will be sold by an Indian company and the tax will presumably bypass Britain and go to India. At the moment, the car is thankfully British designed. He said the same with the Mini, BMW owned and due to be produced overseas too.
Simon?
Well, we got some great comments from readers on this, and what I was trying to do was throw open the debate, so it's interesting to hear his thoughts. But actually, one thing about that Jaguar factory they're going to open in China, they're only going to sell those cars in China. They're not going to make them and then bring them back here. It's important to note. But Lee's got some great comments that he's spotted from readers.
I have, and actually, just on that China note as well, is the fact that it's great that a badge like Jaguar is doing so well and it's so desirable in China that they're having to open a plant in China. It makes much more economic sense for Jaguar to open a plant where the biggest sales are actually happening. And if they're looking to double sales this year, I mean, I don't know what the future holds for Jaguar, but they're looking to really start selling.
But how will that money find its way back here? If we don't own it and you open up a...
It's true, but
in China,
you've got to look at it the other way and say Jaguar's invested heavily in Britain the last couple of years in the fact that it's created thousands of jobs. They've spent a lot of money on a new plant in Solihull. They've a new plant in Wolverhampton.
So we just hand it over to China?
Well, the money that the company is making goes into staff in this country. I mean, you know, they will if they are a success in selling cars in China, they will employ more people here. The company will grow. The people designing those cars are based in this country. The people doing the design of the engineering are based in this country. Well, I was going to say one of the comments here that I'd said Lee was going to pick out, but I'll read it, is from a guy called Tomcat, who said, "So really, this just goes to prove that British engineering and design is world-class, but British professional management is rubbish."
I think that is the best bit of the debate that we could have on this. I mean,
yeah,
that,
why can't that... we manage this? Why can't we take back ownership? We can do everything else.
Well, I tell you what's interesting is basically this all goes back to the problems of the 70s and the early 80s, where you had the British-owned car companies and you had this huge conglomerate, British Leyland. There were strikes, there was bad workmanship going on. I mean, some of the so, for example, when Jaguar launched its XJS back in the 70s, it was meant to be sort of the E-Type replacement, and it was a luxury car, but it worked pretty well, but basically you could get unlucky. There was things called the Friday car, and that was basically the one when everyone was trying to get out the factory quickly to get down the pub.
I've seen Top Gear, I know how it works.
You know, so unfortunately, we made a hash of this, but now, you know, we are now doing really well with it, and these companies are British run. They might be foreign owned, but they're British run, and we're making a really good job of them.
You're passionate about this, aren't you, Simon?
I am passionate about it, and you know, we like to celebrate successes. This is money.
I just think it's genuinely very encouraging that, you know, badges like Jaguar and Rolls-Royce are becoming, you know, or are very popular in these emerging economies where they're getting much more wealth. We wanted to buy British badges, and that's what's happening. And it's getting reinvested in Britain, you know, the research and development side of things. You know, as we pointed out here, it is British designed and it's built by people in Britain.
They've been mooting the idea for a while, but I do have to ask you, Rolls-Royce have finally announced that they will create their first ever luxury 4x4 off-roader, and it will be made in Britain. Your thoughts about that?
I'm not so sure about Rolls-Royce and Bentley 4x4s. I don't know. There's something about a big 4x4 Rolls-Royce. It just doesn't sound quite right, does it? But Porsche have been hugely successful with their Porsche Cayenne, which is their big 4x4. And, you know, our luxury car makers have looked at that and gone, well, people want these cars, and so we're going to try and branch out and make them. And there's, you know, maybe I'm wrong. We shouldn't be stuck in the past. But I tell you what, there was an episode of Top Gear recently where they took a Bentley Continental, which is the sports car, the coupe, and it had four-wheel drive, to Australia and drove it around the outback. And it did amazingly well. It was so funny to see this Bentley just sort of driving around off-road and basically taking any terrain thrown at it in its stride.
Rather than Kensington High Street.
I was about to say, I'm confident, yes, that the rugged terrain of Chelsea High Street will be putting these cars to great use. I will have to also say, no larder, though, really, is it, lads?
It's no larder. But actually, on that 4x4 thing, I mean, I've totally failed to mention Land Rover. Land Rover, which is Jaguar's stablemate, is hugely successful at the moment. The world just cannot get enough Range Rovers. You know, that is a real British success story. So, you know, let's celebrate this.
Let's celebrate indeed. And talking of celebration, guys, congratulations. 1.1 million listens on the audio boom for This Is Money.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Thank you very much, anyone who has listened to that.
Shows you how much financial, you know, radio is needed.
Either that or our mums have got really savvy digitally speaking. Thank you very much to editor Simon Lab, journalist Lee Boyce, back at HQ, Rachel Rickard-Strauss from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website of the Mail online.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.